Welcome to our monthly Q&A with Kim and Jim. This month, they tackled near-death experiences, lucid dreaming, whether consciousness can exist without intelligence, and much more. If you have a question you'd like answered in a future Q&A, you can send your question to mindingthebrainpodcast@gmail.com. We hope you enjoy the episode and look forward to answering more of your questions.
We're going to go to Emily, who has asked, are near-death experiences real? And if so, I feel like we need the X-Files.
Yeah, what are they? Great question. So near-death experiences are real in the sense that people really do have the experiences. That's clear. They're real, at least to the extent that dreams are real, right? And that you actually have them. There are commonalities across cultures sometimes with near-death experiences. Sometimes they're very happy and sometimes they're very hellish and awful. But they're usually defined kind of as a experience you have in your head when you are close to death or perceive yourself to be close to death. And many times these experiences are somewhat affected by your culture and your religion, but often your interpretation of them after you wake up is very much influenced by your culture and your religion. So if you see a bright glowing light in front of you and you're a Christian, you might interpret that as having seen God. What you saw was a light, and you know what it was, what it meant to you. That's a, you know, maybe a matter for interpretation. One big aspect of a near-death experience is called an out-of-body experience, and these have been pretty extensively studied. There are all kinds of out-of-body experiences. The classic one is that you're sort of floating. You have a point of view in your mind's eye of floating above your body, looking down, say, on the operating table or whatever, and they can describe they describe what they saw, and you know, sometimes people are amazed that they just, you know, were able to describe the procedure that was happening or something like that. This is not a heavily studied area. It's actually not easy to get people into near-death experiences to study them, as you might imagine. We can't. I don't know. I don't think it would pass ethics to bring someone close to death.
Oh, I see. Right.
See if you know we could do that. Some studies have shown that although these visions are very convincing, they're not, there are many times that they are not actually seeing what was there. They're wrong about what was happening, but they did have this experience. What causes them? We got a whole lot of theories. We don't really know. We don't really know what causes them. There are a bunch of psychological theories, like it's a stress reaction or a defense mechanism or something like that. There are physiological theories, like your brain, when it's undergoing death or parts of it are starting to die, it might cause certain experiences, which is, you know, quite plausible. There are theories about what we might think of as selective activation. So like in the process of death, certain parts of the brain are more active than others. That might feel like something, right? That might be some kind of an experience. There are theories about the lack of oxygen, which is called hypoxia. Some people, when they are under hypoxia, might not even be near death. They have a narrowing of their vision, right? Which could be interpreted as a tunnel, right? So, maybe like the seeing the tunnel with light at the end of it is actually just hypoxia, narrowing your vision. And then there are theories about pharmacology. So when you are in a hospital setting and you're being given drugs and you're close to death, some of these drugs might have effects on experiences. So long short of it is, near-death experiences do happen. They have been studied, but we have some theories about how they work, but we don't fully understand or can explain how they're working. All right. Okay, now we got a big question from Tyler. Given the uniqueness of every brain, are brain implants a plausible future technology? I think we can both talk about that. You want to start, Kim?
Yeah, I think what I would say is that yes. And it's a scary thought. And I would say brains might be unique in terms of our own experiences, but there's still, we know there are specific parts of the brain that are responsible for specific functions. So for example, our language regions they're all localized in the left temporal posterior junction, right? Broca's area, Wernicke's area. And so if you ever wanted to implant something in that area to promote language or promote speaking or what have you, we would know that's where it would need to go. Does that make sense? So I think there's more that is similar to us than what is actually quite different. I think we'd have to get around the fact that there, if you have something that's a foreign object in the brain, this has, you know, it would need to be withstand the environment of the neural tissue, but we already have that, right? We've done brain implants in particular to treat things like Parkinson's disease. So there's deep brain stimulation. So I'd say I think it's a real possibility down the line in terms of what they would be designed for. That's kind of scary. So it's also sort of the Elon Muskian neuro, what's it called? Neurotech? I want to say Neuralink. Neuralink.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which we've discussed before. I think there's a lot of fascination with that, and it kind of freaks me out. What about you, Jim?
Yeah. So I think that Kim is right. But like I'm a big believer that the uniqueness of the human brain is of each individual brain is a big deal. But it's really, as Kim said, a matter of like degrees, right? So yes, you can stimulate it. You can give a part of a brain more energy, or you can make it not work with certain kinds of, things. And that totally, that works. Yes. And yes. We use you know, a very similar part of the brain to produce language, but, it is very unclear that when that part of the brain is acting to say, produce let's say a thought of speech, for example, like you're imagining saying, I would like a turkey sandwich. I don't think it's at all clear that my thinking, I would like a turkey sandwich, looks anything like Kim's, I would like a turkey sandwich at the neuron firing level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're using the same part of the brain, but there are, you know, what, billions of neurons in those areas, you know?
Trillions of connections.
How many?
Trillions.
Trillions, yeah. So, you know, and remember that the genes for building a brain could fit on a DVD. So, you know, there's a lot of individual generation going on there of the minute areas. So, yeah, for brain technology, right, can we get a brain implant that would allow a person who couldn't move their hands to control a cursor? Maybe.
Yeah.
If they can, like, activate this part of the brain more than that one, you know, but, you know, are we going to brain implants that can, like, read thoughts?
Yeah, no, I don't know.
I don't think that we could do it without training the individual implant on a particular brain. So my implant would have to be trained on my brain, and Kim's implant would have to be trained on hers. I think it's a long way off, as we've mentioned in previous episodes. There are all kinds of medical issues with brain implants too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think that we're going to be having thought reading brain implants in the sense of like being able to detect like what kind of word you're thinking of. With
or like in Severance, when they implant you watch Severance yet?
Yes, I have. Kim's referring to a lot of science fiction in this episode. I have. Yes, I have seen Severance. Great show. And the next question is also about science fiction.
Yeah.
So Diego wants to know, it says shows like Black Mirror depict people achieving immortality by uploading their brains to a virtual environment. Wouldn't this just create a copy of the brain while the original person still experiences death? Could we ever upload a brain in a way that preserves continuity of consciousness? And this is a very deep, interesting question here. A lot of people want to know, like, when you upload, if you upload somebody's, the information in someone's working brain, is that a conscious entity? But Diego's not asking about that. That's another interesting question. This one is about, does it create a separate person, right? And this goes under philosophy as the problem, what's called like a personal identity. It's called personal identity. And it's related to questions like, if you go through a Star Trek transporter, is it you on the other side? Or is it a new being that is very, very similar to you? And the reason it's philosophical is because it's not really a scientific question. Whether or not it is you is not scientific. That is a values question. It's only a scientific question if we use our values to come up with the definition of what it means to be you that we could then test against the real world and observe and say, yeah, well, okay, it matches these criteria. But yeah, if you, let's take the classic, the prototypical uploading. Okay. You scan someone's brain to whatever degree of granularity we need to do. We put that into software and we run it so that we have simulated neurons firing the way that the actual neurons would. Okay. And the idea is that, then you've got a copy of a person living in a computer, maybe in a virtual environment or something like that. Of course, the real person and the simulated person would start diverging at that point. So, you know, is it the same person or not? Well, you know, it's a copy that is now diverging. But science can't say who gets to still be married to the wife and who gets the inheritance and all that. That's not a scientific question. So the second part of this question is, could we ever upload a brain in a way that preserves continuity of consciousness? So some people in the personal identity world believe that the reason that you are the same you as 5 minutes ago is because of this continuity. The brain changes slowly enough. It's always changing, but it's changing slowly enough, and it's made of the same matter that it is still you. So this is also science fiction, but it's a great little thought experiment. Imagine we have, let's take Kim's brain, and we've got Kim's brain at time one and Kim's brain at time two and Kim's brain at time three. And we create a machine that generates Kim's brain at time one and then immediately deletes it and then creates Kim's brain at time two and then immediately deletes it. So there's actually no physical connection between states one and two. Now, as far as talking to this thing, it might sound just like Kim. Kim might think that, oh, I'm experiencing life. I have memories. I remember what happened 4 seconds ago, even though that was a completely different brain. Is that still her? These are not questions that science can answer. And there we have no continuity. It's more like a movie where each slide in the movie, each frame in the in a traditional film is its own picture that has no connection really to the one that came before it. But it just appears when we watch the movie to be a continuous person acting and doing things. It's actually just a bunch of slides. Okay. But that said, maybe we could have some continuity. Maybe we could slowly replace people's brains with something else. Maybe there could be some sort of a syncing of it. Would that mean that it's the same person? That's still a philosophical question.
I need to take a nap after that one. These are deep questions.
Yeah, they're deep questions, and there have been like it's an entire subfield of philosophy, personal identity, talking about, you know, is it you? There's an interesting science fiction book by Canadian author Robert Sawyer called Mind Scan, where when you get old enough, they can scan your mind and put you in a robot and stay on Earth. Meanwhile, the physical biological you goes to the moon to be on like a retirement home and die peacefully.
Yeah, like I used to teach these thought experiments in sensory and perception. It was like, what do you prefer, that you live in your body and you die, or that you, it's like the head, the brain in the jar thought experiment, like, or we take out your brain, put it in a jar, and you're able to live out any experiences that you wish. You could go to Australia, you could go to whatever, like what's your preference? And everybody always wants to be in their body.
Right? Oh, really?
I wouldn't
want to die.
Because they have this, like, my body is me, right? So it's that whole identity issue. What are you? Are you your thoughts and your memories and your experiences, or is your meat suit, you know, like it's wild.
It's interesting that people disagree. Like I would never, I'm not attached to this body. Like to me, like that's not, but I'm not like, you know, what if I was a professional dancer or a model or something? Maybe then it's more important to my personal identity. But for me, if I like, you know, woke up and I was in a completely different body and it was 100 years later and people just explained, oh yeah, sorry, like your body died, but we managed to preserve the brain and put you there. I wouldn't say, oh, I'm not me. You know, I would just be like, oh, okay, well, I'm a little, I got more hair or something. So
well, on that note, these are great questions, and we do encourage our listeners to submit their questions right now to the mindingthebrain@gmail.com. But keep them coming. We love answering these really, really thoughtful questions. The next one's from Chris, who's wondering, will we ever be able to cure schizophrenia? And I would say, I would say probably not, because schizophrenia, like many mental health disorders, doesn't have a unitary cause, nor does it have a unitary gene associated with it. It involves several brain regions, several brain circuits, several neurotransmitters that are implicated. So I think, can we find better pharmacotherapies to treat schizophrenia? Probably. That's where I would go. I think right now we have reasonably good pharmacotherapy. And when we, particularly when we compare to the 1950s before the advent of what were called the first generation antipsychotics, like people who had schizophrenia, were, it was basically you were put into an institution and shuffled off and forgotten about until you died. There really weren't great treatments. And now we're on like third generation antipsychotics. We're really developing much more targeted treatments. But I'll give you sort of like an answer that speaks to the complexity of schizophrenia is that we know one of the areas of the brain that has become dysfunctional in schizophrenia is the area of the brain known as the striatum, which is an area deep in the middle of the brain that it releases dopamine. And it's involved in motor function and thought. And we know that in schizophrenia, there's an excess amount of dopamine activity in the striatum. And that's why the first generation antipsychotics were dopamine blockers. They literally sat on the receptor for dopamine and they occupied it and they prevented dopamine from binding and therefore having action. And that leads to very good clinical symptom release, relief of the primarily the positive symptoms of schizophrenia. But now what we also know is there's areas of the brain where you have too little dopamine. So you have too little, you have what's called dopamine hypofrontality in your prefrontal cortex. So you have too much dopamine in your striatum, you have too little dopamine in the prefrontal cortex. And yet more theories are now showing that there's dysregulated GABA and glutamate. That might actually be a precursor to the alterations in dopamine. So a perfect drug would need to would tune down dopamine in the striatum, tune up dopamine in the prefrontal cortex, and then also re-regulate GABA and glutamate. So you can imagine, and in specific parts of the brain as well. So I would say maybe we need to go beyond pharmacotherapy. Maybe it is brain implants. I don't know. But I think having a cure for schizophrenia outright is probably... not at least I can see that in the next several decades, but who knows, right?
Yeah, right, like not within the scope of the technologies we currently have.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. Because we tend to treat mental illness with pharmacotherapy. And then some like TMS stuff, like transcranial magnetic stimulation. There's now, or deep brain stimulation. So there is now advancing treatments that deal with more the frequency of cells firing as opposed to the chemical signals. But it is... It's a very complex illness. And I think I read a paper a few years ago that shows that schizophrenia is actually probably 8 separate diseases with each their own unique genetic imprint or genetic alterations that are contributing to those 8 separate illnesses. So very complex. We might think schizophrenia is super easy to diagnose. Oh, somebody's having hallucinations or they're having paranoid ideation. But those things can be, as you listen to our episode on hallucinations, you can be hallucinating for a whole bunch of reasons. The hallucinations could be secondary to metabolic disorder. And there's, you know, it's much more complex than people think. Jasmine's asked a really wonderful question about mental illnesses being the same across cultures, but I'm going to actually propose that we do a whole episode on this because I think it's a really cool question that I think there could be a lot on that. I want to give that answer a lot more time.
Our next question is from Marcus. What are lucid dreams and can I train myself to experience them? Okay. This is a great question. Lucid dreams are dreams where you are aware that you are dreaming. That is the very basics of it. Most people have a lucid dream or two in their life. Sometimes people have lucid dreams and don't remember them when they wake up. So you know you're dreaming in the dream. And then furthermore, often you can control what you do and you might even be able to just control the environment through an act of will. So sometimes when I have a lucid dream, I can just decide that the environment is going to be completely different. And it is. I have a friend who has lucid dream nightmares and she can't change what she's looking at. She has to just suffer through it, but she's in complete control. But also, they also tend to be very vivid. People tend to have more lucid dreams when they're younger, and it tends to decline with age. Can you train yourself to experience them? Well, the science suggests that not very well. There are some things you can do, but they don't work very well. But I will tell you what they are. The first is keeping a dream diary. A dream diary is you write down in a notebook as soon as you wake up everything you can remember about your dreams, and you periodically review these things. Keeping a dream diary helps you remember your dreams, and there is some evidence to suggest that it will help you become lucid. It's mysterious why, but remembering your dreams is an important part of it. You know, maybe it's that the better you get at remembering your dreams, the better you are remembering the lucid dreams that you have. So I'm not sure about that, but keeping a dream diary is important. And another is a reality check. And a reality check is when you check to see if you are actually living in reality. Now, that might sound kind of strange because, well, you're in reality right now and you know it, right? Well, yes, but when you're in a dream, you also are under the illusion that you're in reality. So the idea is that you get into a habit of doing reality checks. And then if you're lucky, you do this reality check in your dream, and then you realize, oh my goodness, I'm dreaming. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what would these reality checks look like? Well, one is technology doesn't work very well in dreams. Watches don't work. Cell phones don't work very well. Things are always malfunctioning. So one habit you can make is every time you're using a piece of technology and it is malfunctioning, do a separate reality check to see if you're dreaming or not. Okay. So what might that be? Well, one thing that is pretty reliable with dreams is that text changes. So if you look at text and you read it and you look away and you look back in a dream, it will often say something different. So one thing that I try to do when I'm walking down the street is I might see, McLaren. I'll look away, I'll look back and see if the street sign still says McLaren. And it feels kind of stupid to do this, but you won't do it in your dream unless you make it a habit. So the idea is you just double check every time you look, you look at your watch, you look at text, you look away and you do a reality check. And eventually you'll do it in your dream and you can suddenly say, oh my goodness, I'm dreaming. That's great. The other is you can have an intention. You think about it. You think, I'm going to have a lucid dream tonight. I'm going to try to wake up in my dream. You think about that every night. Those are the things I would recommend. Dream diary, reality checks, usually rereading text, particularly when technology malfunctions, and then setting an intention before you go to bed. But as I said, they don't work all that well. This is certainly not a guaranteed path to having lucid dreams. Our next question is from Sophie. The science fiction novel Blindsight by Peter Watts depicts a highly intelligent organisms that evolved without consciousness or awareness. Is this a plausible idea? Okay, great question. yeah, can you have really intelligent beings without consciousness?
Without consciousness.
Yeah. And the answer is we have no idea. We really, really don't. We don't understand consciousness well enough to know that. We don't know what consciousness is for. So, for example, if you look at artificial intelligence, the world of artificial intelligence, where we have some very, very bright people trying very, very hard to make computers think, and do the kind of things that people can do. Almost none of them are trying to make consciousness because we don't know why it would be useful.
Mm.
It doesn't appear to be useful for memory retrieval. It doesn't appear to be useful for planning. It doesn't appear to be useful for imagination. So why would we even have to put it in? There doesn't appear to be a reason to engineer consciousness in a being that you just want to do some cognitive job. However, human beings are conscious and probably other animals are too, with similar brains and things, but we don't know. If there's an alien species, okay, that has very different brains than ours, would they need, is consciousness a necessary thing for highly intelligent thought and behavior? Okay. Now, maybe the answer might be yes. If one highly intelligent and complex thought requires enormous complexity, and consciousness is a natural emergence of that kind of complexity. So it sort of has to come along with it, right? But as I said, we don't know that. There are some consciousness researchers who believe that.
Yeah, kind of made that assumption.
We don't know. I mean, there are theories. They're very complex, but there are certain kinds of complexity that they say that any system that demonstrates these kinds of complexities has consciousness, you know. But, you know, it's very hard to find evidence for that because we don't really have an objective measure of consciousness that isn't theory laden, right? So you have a definition of consciousness that is sort of based on a theory, but if you're trying to, you know, prove that theory using it, it's sort of circular. So yeah, we don't, I'm just gonna have to say consciousness is mysterious and we don't have any idea about it.
Consciousness is mysterious, as is the brain. And that wraps up our another Q&A.
Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And we'll see you next time.